Welcome to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and we have a very special subject in store for you today. I think you're going to find it fascinating. It's something we haven't yet done on Intelligent Medicine, but it is very deserving of attention. It's the current epidemic of Lyme disease and also tick-borne illnesses, because it's not just confined to classic Lyme disease. We're going to talk to an expert. She's Dr. Harriet Kotsouras. She is Chief Scientific Officer for an outfit called the Lyme Research Alliance. They're doing some great work to advance research and promote public awareness of Lyme disease and other tick-borne illnesses. Her background is that she has been in private practice as a neurologist at Stanford Hospital, which is right at the heart of the Lyme epidemic. She is by trade a neurologist, which means she focuses on the nervous system and the brain, and that's a very important part of how Lyme disease and other diseases affect people. Her training is at Columbia, and without further ado, welcome to the program, Harriet.
Thank you very much, Dr. Hoffman.
It's nice having you on the program. Tell us a little bit, first of all, the mission of the Lyme Research Alliance.
Well, our mission statement is to fund research into Lyme and other tick-borne diseases. We support via the private sector, university-based and foundation-based research into these disorders.
Okay, so you're getting the word out, and then if people go to the website, what's the website?
LymeResearchAlliance.org.
Okay, and what can they find there? What are some of the resources available for doctors and patients?
Everything. We have a section about Lyme disease, what to do if you're bitten by a tick. It talks about our research, our researchers. It talks about our fundraising activities in order to obtain funds to fund the researchers. It talks about all sorts of things in the news about Lyme and other tick-borne diseases. We give advice as to, where to go for certain information. We also have a bibliography for all the Sentinel articles about Lyme disease going way back up to the present. There's a slew of information there. You could spend days combing our website.
Great. Okay, so a lot of resources there. So to frame the argument, there's a great deal of controversy about Lyme disease, as you well know. As a physician, you know that the battle lines are drawn, because there's some physicians who say, look, there's Lyme disease and there's another few tick-borne illnesses, which we'll get into later. They each have a way of being properly diagnosed and a way of being properly treated, and yet there are hundreds and thousands of individuals running around saying that they have chronic disease, unresolved Lyme disease, or the chronic aftermath of a tick-borne illness. And it is those individuals who feel that they're getting shafted because they're not getting proper attention. There's not enough studies. There's not enough treatment options. And in fact, insurance companies and sometimes conventional medical organizations and doctors are saying that, look, there's no such thing as chronic Lyme disease. You take an antibiotic, you eradicate it, okay, if you don't feel good, something else is going on. So frame that controversy for us. I know there are no easy answers. But,
no, there certainly isn't. But let me start with this. We are a very mainstream organization that funds fact-based, evidence-based medicine and research. And clearly, the problem with Lyme disease and other tick-borne diseases is that oftentimes the diagnostic test is not accurate.
Okay.
And the best
and
of
I think that needs to be said, up front, because,
yes,
people say, look, the test is positive, the test is negative, it's straightforward. So, why are you saying that you might still have Lyme disease?
Because 65% of the time you will get a true positive. in terms of diagnostic testing. And the diagnostic test is faulty because it tests the antibodies to the Lyme spirochete in your blood. The blood test may be done too soon and not detect the antibody level. The test that's run currently is against certain strains of Lyme disease, and there are over 100 strains that you may be infected with in the United States alone, 300 strains worldwide. And there are some people who may not have a very competent immune system, and they may not mount enough of an antibody response to be detected in the current laboratory testing. So we're trying to dispel the myth that Lyme disease is easy to diagnose and easy to treat. The fact of the matter is, and there's a lot of literature out there now, that it is difficult to diagnose and oftentimes, if not treated in a timely and adequate manner, difficult to treat. Even in the best of hands, timely diagnosis, adequate treatment, and by that I mean maybe 3 to 4 weeks of oral antibiotics after getting a rash or seeing a tick bite, getting a positive blood test, whatever, about 10 to 15% of patients still will not be completely cured. And we're trying to promote this research. We're trying to drive the science forward to find out why that's the case.
And I guess the big controversy is, do these people still have live spirochetes or live organisms of other types in their bloodstream that are not successfully treated? Or do they merely have some aftermath, as if the immune system is kicked into overdrive or into an inflammatory state, and the Lyme disease is not so much the target, but we need to do some repair on those people because they're immune dysregulated?
My gut tells me it's probably both. However, okay. Only the animal studies have shown persistent either organisms in connective tissue or DNA and RNA fragments of the Lyme spirochete. We haven't been able to date to detect that in human beings. What we have been able to show is something called biofilms. These weird jelly-like, I don't know how else to simplify the description, this microscopic jelly-like conglomerate of kind of dormant, morphed spirochetes that seem to float around or lodge in tissues of the human body.
Well, the analogy would be people who have chronic sinus infections, they may have biofilms in their nasal passages that prevent the antibiotics from reaching the organisms.
That's
or their
right.
own immune systems. Or conversely, biofilms are well known in dentistry because they form mm-hmm. Tartar and plaque, and they protect the bugs that drill into our teeth and cause cavities.
That's right. You hit the nail on the head. Absolutely. And then one of our other researchers has clearly shown that there is a genetic predisposition in certain people when they have had a Lyme infection. It does throw their immune system into overdrive, and the end result, the final common pathway, is very similar to other autoimmune diseases like rheumatoid arthritis and lupus, and all sorts of other autoimmune connective tissue diseases. So my guess is that it may be a little bit of both in some of these what we call chronic Lyme disease patients, long-term Lyme disease patients, or what some people also like to call post-Lyme disease syndrome. No one has ever come to any consensus as to what to call this thing. And I think it's because, as you said, nobody really knows what it is, what this phenomenon is truly. And that's another reason why Lyme Research Alliance has been at the forefront of driving this science forward with the private sector funding that we do.
And part of the dilemma for patients is that these days it's very hard to be a Lyme-literate physician. Someone who understands all the ramifications of Lyme disease, the subtleties, the mysteries, and keeps up to date on the latest research. So unfortunately for the average inhabitant of Connecticut, Rhode Island, New York, they may see their primary care doctor who just does a routine test, says perhaps, you know, the test came out negative. I guess something else is going on with you. Maybe you have fibromyalgia. Maybe you have depression. Maybe you're suffering from osteoarthritis, when actually that person may have a tick-borne illness.
That's correct. Absolutely. Well, you know, my impression also is that it's, you know, it, medicine, the whole medical environment has changed, and it's very hard to find a physician who will be able to kind of comb through a lot of these signs and symptoms, who has the time these days to comb through a lot of these
right.
signs and symptoms. And it's terrible to say that a Lyme disease sufferer or a tick-borne disease sufferer, it is a very difficult patient. It's a very time-consuming, mentally and physically consuming situation to be able to take care of these patients. They are very sick, and that's why I think it's important that these particular patients see a specialist, because these are the people who can fast-track the right diagnosis and treatment.
But also, there is actually a great deal of variability among specialists. Some people are, frankly, perhaps too gung-ho to diagnose tick-borne illness. You know, anybody comes in with perhaps brain fog or mild mood disturbance, and immediately they're thinking Lyme disease. On the other hand, you have people who are super conservative. They're very reluctant to offer the diagnosis of a tick-borne illness. And so how do you know where to find somebody who's rational, reasonable, and situated, say, in the middle of the spectrum?
Right. Well, there are physicians like that out there, but you are so right. Yes, there are people who will always capitalize on people's misery. And there are others who, you know, just think and, you know, cannot think out of the box and have to think black and white. But you see, the bottom line problem is we don't have a great diagnostic test. If we could only get a 90, 95, even 100% accurate diagnostic test for acute Lyme disease in the earliest of early stages, and some type of marker or, again, diagnostic test for those who have chronic Lyme, who have either not been successfully treated or who have gone on to suffer for a long time totally undiagnosed and untreated because, you know, they fall into this nebulous faction of patients that really don't have a lot to hang, you know, the diagnosis on, but still, nonetheless, are not functioning up to par. In fact, statistics show that many of these chronic Lyme patients don't do much better than a very sick congestive heart failure patient.
Wow, the quality of life is that bad. The
quality of life is terrible, right.
Yeah. Well, now there are a wide variety of tick-borne illnesses. As you mentioned, there may be 300 different strains of Lyme disease worldwide, and we tend to think of it as something that the epicenter is in Lyme, Connecticut, and it's a northeastern disease, but actually there are Lyme disease patients all over the world and in parts of the United States where you wouldn't expect it to be. And
right.
Some people have provided the analogy of a tick bite as being akin to getting a dirty needle stick, because ticks rarely have just a single pathogen that they're carrying. It's not just Lyme. They may also have other bugs along for the ride, like Babesia, Anaplasma, Ehrlichia, Bartonella, and now a potential new viruses. So
mm-hmm.
give us a lowdown
Powassan,
on some of those other.
Yeah, Powassan virus, yeah.
Right, yeah. I mean, now you mention it, this is alarming. New potentially fatal tick-borne illness found in local areas.
Right.
This is the Wadsworth Center. They do the, that's like the think tank of the health department in New York State. They found that there is something called the Powassan virus.
Mm-hmm.
It's been found upstate in Saratoga, Albany, Rensselaer, and Columbia counties.
Mm-hmm.
And people get pretty sick from it. It ultimately leads to death in about 10 to 30% of the cases.
Well,
that is super scary.
Right. It's super scary, and especially if you're immunocompromised in any way, if you're on steroids for some other illness, if you're a cancer chemotherapy patient, or if you have something you know, wrong with your immune system to begin with, it'll be much worse. Or if you've lost your spleen for some reason.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, these patients are at higher risk. Yes, absolutely. I think of tick belly as a cesspool. There are tons and tons of organisms in there. Some may be disease-producing, some may not. So we call them the disease-producing ones pathogens, and then there are the others that go on for a ride that are what we call symbionts. You know, they're kind of just living along, getting a free ride inside the tick. But the other thing about that is with a tick bite, these pathogens, these disease-producing organisms have different transmission times. If a tick does bite you and adheres to your body, it probably will take more than 24 hours to transmit Borrelia burgdorferi, the causative organism of Lyme disease. But the other pathogens can be transmitted to your bloodstream far more quickly. And so when you get a tick bite, even if it hasn't been on you that long, you should really be very wary about your signs and symptoms going forward because you could have picked up something else.
Okay, so this scenario, common scenario, people, you know, are in the yard, they're, you know, hanging out with their pets, or a kid comes in, or you notice that there's a tick adhering to your body. I mean, there are two basic types of ticks in this northeastern area where we're broadcasting from. This is one that's a big, hard-bodied tick, and then there's the very small, tiny deer tick. So what do you do?
So, well, if it's a black-legged, well, probably the best thing, because some people are going to say, well, how am I going to know if this is the disease-carrying
right.
black-legged deer tick, Azotes scapularis, here in the northeast? Probably the best thing you can do is to try to remove it carefully with fine-point tweezers. Try not to squeeze the tick belly while you're doing it.
Because that's a little bit like pushing on a syringe.
Right. You're just going to inject all those pathogens inside the bloodstream. Try to pull it out via its mouth parts carefully. You can put it in a plastic bag with a moist cotton ball and take it to your local Department of Health.
Mm-hmm.
Many communities...
I've had a few patients bring those in to me. By the time they bring those in to me, it's too late.
They're dried up, right?
It's like take it to the Department of Health. Right.
And they will run the test. And here in Greenwich, they will test it for Lyme, Babesia, and anaplasma.
Okay.
And
so
other communities may send it out just for Lyme. But at least it'd be helpful to know. And they'll also identify the tick.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they'll say, oh, no, don't worry about it. It was just a dog tick, and it's fine.
Yeah. Okay. And, but as a physician, what do you do? Do you automatically, reflexly prescribe antibiotics? I mean, people call me up on the telephone. They say, I've been bitten by a tick. They're frantic. Do I need a prescription right away?
Well, I think this is a controversial topic. I can tell you what's in the literature. If you think you've had a tick bite by the appropriate type of tick and it's adhered to you for more than 24 hours, some doctors will prescribe doxycycline 100 milligrams.
For 2 weeks, right?
For two doses.
Oh, just two doses.
Two doses.
That's like a needle, almost like a needle stick prophylaxis in a hospital.
Exactly.
Right.
And watch you. But
right.
You will, if you look at some of the literature and you follow some of these patients out, and again, this literature is not all that well studied and all that clear.
And that's what you're doing at the Lyme Research Alliance. You're trying to rationalize
with
rules of the road.
Right, absolutely. But there will be some people who will go on to develop Lyme disease, and it could be up to 3/4 of these people.
Wow.
And again, those numbers are not clear-cut, but the indications are it could be up to 75%. But after something like that, if you get the tick tested, comes back negative from your Department of Health, you can somewhat have a little breath of relief.
Okay.
But you should still be careful and, you know, just wary of things.
Mm-hmm.
People know their own bodies. If something is off, they just don't feel quite right. They
mm-hmm.
have these funny fevers. They get these night sweats. They feel a little bit more tired. It doesn't hurt to get checked and have a blood test for whatever it's worth. At least get a panel and be checked for Ehrlichia, anaplasma, babesia, and Lyme disease. And
how often do you get that characteristic bullseye rash? Some people say, well, I didn't get a rash, so I must be fine.
It's probably about less than 50% because there are some people who do get them and don't see them because they're on parts of their body that
mm-hmm.
they can't see.
Yeah.
If somebody
it's like
else
the
is
back
noticing.
Of your thigh or something like that. Yeah.
Exactly. And sometimes the ring can be so large that it can be obscured within, say, the hair as well.
Yeah.
And you can only see part of the ring.
Mm.
It's very strange because, you know, ticks like to go to warm parts of the body, warm, moist parts of the body. So at the base of the neck, behind the ear, in the and the armpits, the groin, back of the knees. And if you get a rash there, you know, you might not see it if it's not big enough. And there's a recent study by some of the people that we have funded in the past that showed that the characteristic bullseye rash may actually not be the most common rash that you actually see from a tick bite, from Lyme disease. A lot of these rashes resemble bad spider bites.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, most dermatologists might have a difficult time discerning between a Lyme rash and, a true Lyme rash and a bullseye.
So, in effect, it could be anything.
That's right.
Yeah. So, what signs and symptoms should make you suspicious that you may have a chronic bug, be it chronic Lyme disease? I mean, you're a neurologist, so you're attuned to this. Things that ordinarily you might not associate with Lyme disease may be due to a tick-borne illness.
Right. Well, early on, I think the thing that we do seem to try to impress upon people is the, quote, summer flu.
Mm-hmm.
That's a little unusual. So if you get something weird that resembles the flu, you should think Lyme disease, and of course West Nile as well, but Lyme disease, and especially in these hotspot endemic areas. Going forward, beyond that, a disseminated disease, late-stage Lyme disease, characteristically is a lot of fatigue.
How many months later might that develop?
Could be more. It could be 6 months or longer. Could even be a couple of years, one
mm-hmm.
or 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
It's very similar to syphilis in terms of showing up later and in other ways. The Northern Hemisphere picture, as opposed to the European corridor, usually shows up late as a kind of chronic fatigue, cognitive dysfunction, chronic pain type picture, a lot of musculoskeletal pain, arthritis, arthritic symptoms, knees, hips, many of these patients will have a positive Lyme Western blot, but again, many of them won't. So that may be the later manifestations. In Europe, interestingly enough, and it's probably because of the different strains, it resembles more of the spinal cord type involvement with syphilis. You get a lot of nerve root pain, numbness, tingling, a lot of spinal cord and peripheral nerve symptomatology in Europe in the later stages.
Well, you know, what you've just said is super scary, because what you've described lies in the realm of the symptoms of perhaps 60% of the population, particularly as people age. You know, how do you know that you're not, whether you're suffering from age-related fatigue or osteoarthritis or, you know, just those aches and pains that people are prey to past a certain age, whatever it is, 45, 55, or 65, or whether you actually have Lyme disease as the underlying cause of all this?
That's absolutely true. That's the big problem. Again, we don't have a good test to say this is what you have.
Mm-hmm.
You have to take a very careful history, do a very careful exam. If you have a swollen joint, hopefully you can extract some fluid from the joint and analyze it. It might give you a clue.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe you'll be lucky and have a positive blood test. You know, it's tough. It's mm-hmm. tough to make that diagnosis.
Sometimes this results in what is called a presumptive trial of therapy. And by later dates, even the oral antibiotics, and sometimes exotic antibiotics are used for long periods of time in different combinations, or intravenous antibiotics are even employed to see if patients will respond.
That's right. That's right. But with the intravenous antibiotics in particular, it's very difficult to get the insurance companies
right.
to agree to pay
for
that.
They're very wary of that. And you know, perhaps rightly so, because sometimes it's a wild goose chase.
Mm-hmm.
Other times it may be life-saving therapy or, you know, something that can really turn things around for patients. I know that one of your colleagues, actually he's been a guest on this on my radio program many years ago, Dr. Brian Fallon,
uh-huh.
has conducted research on how people respond to intravenous antibiotics, because commonly people are dosed with high doses of intravenous Rocephin and other types of things. And what are the results of those studies? Do people get cured? Is it worthwhile? Does it make a difference?
No, people do not get cured. However, if you do an in-depth analysis of his particular study, you'll find that some people do improve in terms of their pain and chronic fatigue. Some people will relapse, but others will get better. You have to kind of tease out some of those statistics. But the problem with a lot of those studies that came out was that the patient, the sample size was much too small, or they didn't follow the patients far enough out. And also, those studies didn't factor in, which we know now is very important, the immune system component to a lot of these patients who are suffering from chronic inflammation.
And by that, you mean that some people have immune problems that make them less likely to throw off their Lyme disease, or more likely to have a very severe reaction to the presence of Lyme or other pathogens?
That the Lyme disease infection itself has created in them a hyperactive immune system, much like an autoimmune disease. And they haven't been treated in a way that can try to dampen that hyperactive, hyperimmune situation.
But the dilemma is, you know, if you treat it like lupus or rheumatoid arthritis with immune suppressive medications, that may make the spirochete or other pathogens explode, because if you suppress the immune system, it won't be able to defend.
Well, hopefully what you're trying to do is actually dampen the inappropriately active B cells, the B white cells that are cranking out these autoantibodies, these antibodies that are attacking your own natural tissue. And the drugs that are used for that, and of course you have to have a really good firm diagnosis before you give these people these types of drugs.
Mm-hmm.
But Plaquenil, in particular, has been shown to be very helpful.
It's an anti-parasite medication, basically.
That's right. Yep. Hydroxychloroquine.
Yep. So that can be part of the regimen that can be safely administered, perhaps with antibiotics, just to sort of cool down this over-exuberant immune reaction.
Right.
So, yeah, a lot of dilemmas, and you're trying to work these out with research. You know, there's a lot of other tests besides the Lyme serology and the Western blot tests that are being touted. There's PCR tests. There are urine tests. It seems like every day some, quote, innovative lab is coming up with yet another way to diagnose Lyme disease. Are these half-baked theories, or is there something to them?
No, there's something to them. It's just that, you know, everybody has different standardizations, and it's hard to compare one lab to the other. And, you know, there's if you think the United States has a lot of tests available, Europe is even worse. It's hard to know what laboratory to rely upon. However, we have funded and are funding state-of-the-art medicine research into diagnostic testing using amplified polymerase chain reaction analysis. This is to pick up the genetic fragments of the Lyme organism and other, the other co-infections. And also using something called mass spectroscopy that makes a diagnosis based on molecular weight of combinations of genetic material, so that based on this molecular weight footprint, you can make a determination what organism this particular person might have in their blood or skin or something like that.
So not quite ready for prime time, but under development.
But pretty close.
Okay.
And in fact, it's actually used by the government. I mean, when the government finds white powder in an envelope and, you know, in some senator's office, this is the state-of-the-art analysis that this particular white powder will go through to find out if it's anthrax or not. So we're trying to use the this type of technology to get it to the regular, you know, to the public, to the everyday patient, trying to make it reliable, quick, and affordable, and that's one of the goals of our mission to fund these particular researchers, to get a good diagnostic test like that out there in the market.
Okay. Well, clearly there's a role for very aggressive conventional treatment, the appropriate antibiotics, sometimes oral, sometimes even intravenous. But what about the role of alternative therapies? Many of your patients gravitate towards various alternative therapies, acupuncture, they take supplements, they perform Tai Chi, or they get techniques like Reiki. Do you see a role for natural approaches in ameliorating the symptoms?
I've always looked at it this way. I have a very open mind. If it doesn't do any harm, why not? If the person claims that it makes them feel better, why not? If they have the means to pay for it, why not? Clearly, if you raise a body temperature, and this is not so easy to do, to 103 degrees, a lot of these, if you believe in...
That's hyperthermia.
Hyperthermia. If you believe in these Lyme organisms, biofilms lodged in tissue, in connective tissue of the body, raising the body temperature either in a steam bath or a hot tub can sometimes flush some of these organisms out. And a lot of people say that after they do that and if they're on antibiotics, they feel like they feel much better. It's almost like they've killed off some of the organisms. Who knows? I mean, there seems to be some common sense logic to it. Supplements, I think anything that will help make the immune system more competent to fight off infection.
Perhaps things
not?
Like vitamin D, omega-3 fatty acids, some of the standards.
Sure. Mm-hmm. Why not? It's not going to hurt the patient at all.
Okay, so you're a neurologist. So you see a lot of standard neurology patients, patients with conditions like multiple sclerosis or Parkinson's disease or Alzheimer's disease or even ALS, Lou Gehrig's disease. Do you ever see patients who really surprise you because it turned out all along that they might have had Lyme disease or a tick-borne illness?
Yes. Well, I am retired. I don't have a private practice anymore, but I've
been in the research setting, perhaps. Yeah.
You're right. I'm a full-time volunteer, in terms of doing the research grant work for Lyme Research Alliance. But when I was in practice, many of these patients were virtually indistinguishable from patients with multiple sclerosis, and a lot of them had a weakness and muscle problems that would make one suspect that they had Lou Gehrig's disease. But they ended up being serologically positive for Lyme.
And the problem is even an MRI will actually, an MRI in a Lyme disease patient might resemble an MRI in a multiple sclerosis patient.
That's right. Yep, they'll have white matter disease just the same.
Wow.
And even in the same type of pattern and distribution. It's frightening. I think because the final common pathway for some of these diseases is quite similar, either inflammatory chemicals or localized immune reactions will cause the same pathological changes microscopically.
How about patients who have fibromyalgia or depression, chronic fatigue syndrome, or patients who don't respond to the ordinary medications?
Mm-hmm. That's an interesting topic. We funded a researcher, Dr. Schutzer from UMDNJ, and one of his first articles to come out about a year or 2 years ago now, looked at the spinal fluid in chronic fatigue syndrome patients, normal patients, and patients with post-treatment Lyme syndrome, for lack of a better term. And there he found unique proteins in the the chronic fatigue syndrome group and the chronic Lyme group, identifying two distinct disease entities. So there may be symptoms that overlap, but from a pathological point of view, there is a different disease process going on.
But nonetheless, these tests are not yet readily available to the average practitioner.
No, not yet.
Okay, they're in the research stage. So let's talk briefly about some of these other infections. We've got Ehrlichiosis, Bartonella, we've got anaplasma infections, Babesiosis. Are they similar in their manifestations to Lyme, or how would you suspect that perhaps you might be suffering from one of those?
If we distill these down, this may be a gross oversimplification, but babesia, I think of that almost like a malarial, malarial type illness.
So like cyclic fevers.
Cyclic fevers, you know, shaking chills, and of course a blood smear that will show that these parasites are inside the red blood cells of the patient.
Particularly bad for people who are immunosuppressed or don't have spleens.
That's right.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Which is more and more common these days with automobile accidents and autoimmune disease. There are a lot of people walking around without spleens.
That's right. And another frightening fact is that the strain of Babesia that's in Europe carries a 50% mortality rate.
Hmm. I think there's some concern that there might be transferred with blood transfusions, too.
That's right. We don't screen. We don't have a good screening test for Babesia in the blood supply yet.
Yikes.
And people are calling for that because of the increasing prevalence of Babesia in these ticks, especially in this area. It used to be you couldn't even find it in a deer tick. Now up to 30% of the deer ticks in this area will carry babesiosis as well.
Wow. And Ehrlichia?
Ehrlichia, the hallmark of Ehrlichia, it's also a flu-like, acutely, a flu-like disease presentation, but it's a very precipitous rise in a high, high fever early on. Should make a clinician suspicious of Ehrlichia.
Mm-hmm. Particularly in a month where you might not expect that.
That's right.
Okay. And, yeah, the other more obscure conditions, anaplasma, Bartonella. Bartonella sometimes, isn't that the cat scratch fever?
That's right. That's one of them. Yes, that's one of the many Bartonella species, yes.
Okay. That's not just a rock and roll song.
No.
Okay. It's a real entity. Okay, so I mean, clearly we got a lot of unknowns.
Mm-hmm.
But so where do you, I mean, are you confident that the research is going to proceed via organizations like Lyme Research Alliance and other research entities so that in 5 or 10 at most years we'll have an answer to some of these conundrums?
I hope it's a lot sooner, but I have to say that the private sector funding is key because we all know of the government cutbacks. NIH has cut again about 7-8% from the Lyme disease research budget. It's a tough business out there as a nonprofit. But Lyme Research Alliance is proud to say that we're one of the leading, if not the leading, funders in the private sector arena. And trying to drive the science forward. And we try to drive it not only in terms of the diagnostics, but also looking at alternative treatments or treatments for chronic Lyme. And also we do fund a lot of epidemiology and prevention. We have a study going on now in the upper Midwest trying to see how man's alteration of the environment is having an impact on the spread of these diseases throughout the United States in places that, we never saw this before.
So
I had so few cases before.
So from a more prosaic standpoint, what measures can people take to protect themselves from tick-borne illnesses or, perhaps also for their kids and pets?
Well, there are a couple of things. If you are going to be in an endemic area, in an at-risk situation, either hiking, gardening, it's always nice to wear light-colored clothes, long sleeves, tuck your pants into your socks, spray yourself with a tick repellent. DEET will work.
And that's not toxic or dangerous for kids?
There may be an age cutoff. I'm not a pediatrician. It could be an age cutoff of about age 6. I'm not sure. Or it could even be younger. But Picardin, P-I-C-A-R-D-I-N, is the tick repellent that you can only spray on clothes and is not good for kids or pets.
Mm-hmm.
But DEET is very good, especially to spray on your clothes. And there are other tick repellents you can spray on the soles of your shoes. And then the other important thing to do when you come inside is you can take your clothes off and throw them in the dryer and run them for a while in the dryer to kill the ticks and also to do a good tick check on yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And we talk about our pets as tick taxis.
Yeah.
If the pets have been outside rummaging around in leaf, in leaves and foliage and in damp, moist, dark areas in particular, definitely check them before they come inside, because they're the ones that can bring them in to, you know, infect the family.
Well, what happened to all this talk about the vaccines? Because I have vaccines for pets, and then it didn't pan out for people. It actually made people sick, and it seems that there's a hiatus on research looking at vaccines.
I believe you will be hearing about a new vaccine that was tested in Europe that seems to be pretty effective. So there may be a resurgence of that, and they may be bringing out a vaccine in the United States within the next year or two.
Well, the last one that was offered, there were some untoward side effects, correct?
That's right. The Lymerix, there were some people who did develop arthritis themselves. I'm wondering if perhaps these were people who were vaccinated who had unknown chronic Lyme, and somehow it kind of messed up their immune system in some way. I'm just wondering.
In other words, they may have had Lyme, and then this may have reactivated or set off their immune system that was already recognizing Lyme.
Correct.
Yeah.
Perhaps. I mean, it's just a hypothesis,
right,
to throw out there, because there may not have been all that much trouble with, you know, all that much problem with Lymerix, but there was a lot of pressure to remove it from the market.
Right. Well, you know, with liability and so on, going to really trash any kind of research project. The question that I've been dying to ask is, and I've been thinking about this, is if there was an ironclad test for exposure to Lyme disease, 100% effective, and you tested each and every healthy person who claims they're perfectly well in the northeast of the United States, what percentage of people do you think would be positive to that? Because I suspect a lot of this has to do not just with serendipity, did you get bitten by a tick, but it may actually have to do with your terrain, your own immune system. And it could be that some people have mild infections or throw this off.
That's right. So you're talking all healthy, just healthy.
Healthy, yeah, people without complaints. People without complaints.
I would say
60, I've got a couple aches and pains, but you know.
Yeah, I would say maybe 5, 10, maybe 15% will test positive. Mm-hmm. And it's probably because they have a very mild strain that has very little infectivity or virulence.
Mm-hmm.
Or as you say, they may have such a competent, such a capable immune system that they can clear the infection without antibiotics.
Mm-hmm.
And I do think it depends on the body, you know, person's own body and constitution, and the strain that they're infected with.
I mean, we've seen this with different, racial types with malaria. You know, like when the Europeans came to malaria-ridden areas of Africa, they just died like flies.
Right.
The Africans, I mean, some of them get sick, but some of them are well adapted to it. You know,
mm-hmm.
So, I mean, entire populations of colonists in South America and in Africa, they went hopefully, from whatever country in Northern Europe they were from and tried to colonize this beautiful tropical paradise, and they all died because their immune systems weren't prepared for this. It may be that some people have selectively have better immunity.
Mm-hmm.
We have to harness their secret.
Right. And let's look at it this way. All of the landscapers and gardeners that are out there, why aren't they all...
Right.
Sick as dogs, you know.
I've treated a few of them for Lyme disease.
why aren't there more?
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm wondering whether if they're repetitively bitten,
right,
if they develop some type of immunity to the disease.
Well, if you've ever had a conversation with a landscaper or somebody who's a gardener, you might wonder, what's the level? I don't know. I'm not leveling any kind of criticism of our gardening friends, but.
No, but they're stoic individuals. They probably have aches and pains, but they chuck it off to hard work. So
that's right.
Hard to know. There probably are a lot of people out there suffering that really have the disease.
Right, and there is this thing, when you go out to the east end of Long Island, everybody has this thing they call Montauk Knee,
mm-hmm.
which is...
I've heard of that.
Yeah, which, one suspects that maybe they all got bitten by Lyme ticks, and it's not just because... they're suffering the aches and pains that are age-related.
Mm-hmm.
But who knows? I think that's one of the issues that y'all are working on at the Lyme Research Alliance. So once again, give out the website.
LymeResearchAlliance.org.
Okay. And there you can get more information. You can also contribute. Also, you have very nice events. Sometimes people can come to benefits and participate.
Yes, we do. We have an informative session with one of our researchers working on bacterial persistence after antibiotic treatment, Dr. Kim Lewis, who will be speaking at a Mercedes event in White Plains at Pepe Auto Group on the evening of September 25th. It's a Wednesday night. That should be publicized fairly soon if it's not already there.
Great, and yes, I hope that, you know, after we complete this podcast, maybe you'll link and put this podcast up, because I think it was an informative one. We got a lot of information out.
I hope so. I think that'd be a great idea. It's been a pleasure to speak with you.
It's my pleasure. So our guest is Dr. Harriet Kotsouras. She's Chief Scientific Officer for the Lyme Research Alliance. All the best to you, Dr. Kotsouras. And,
Thank you so much.
We hope that you come up with some answers for the many long-suffering individuals out there with tick-borne illnesses. I'm sure you're hard at work at it.
We do, too. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.